Thank you very much. Hopefully we'll manage to have a cup of tea. There's never enough time when we get together as astrologers to talk about our favourite subject, our passion, our life. But unfortunately we have to draw the line somewhere. So now it gives us great pleasure to introduce our special guest this afternoon, Dr. Geoffrey Cornelius, of international fame. He's a flash of thought, I know. Very well known astrologer, with his book, The Moment of Astrology, Origins of Divination. Geoffrey has co-founded the Company of Astrologers along with Maggie Hyde. I think that might have been in the 1980s.
A long time ago. And two other astrologers, Derek Appleby and Gordon Watson, two other astrologers.
Geoffrey has been teaching us horary lately, running courses of that, as long as being extremely busy with his co-tutor, Dr. Angela Voss, at the Canterbury Christchurch University MA, where they both act as tutors, and I'm very honoured to be taught by both of them. But Geoffrey is here this afternoon with his talk, Entering Symbol, Astrologer's Path and Practice. So please.
Thank you very much. Now, firstly, basics. Can you hear me? Good. Okay. Well, thank you for welcoming me here. It is an honour to speak at the faculty, and I've got a long, friendly connection with the faculty over many, many years, because the faculty has been such a super school, keeping together really good practice to a really high level. Because astrology is a wonderful thing, but if it's not actually done, if it's not practiced, then there's nothing much, is there? It just remains a wonderful historical idea. So all of us here are the living practice of astrology. We are that. And it's most precious that we gather together. So thank you to the faculty for this tremendous function. And I love very much what Cat Cox said about the tradition that we're in, the transmission that runs down over the ages. So, now I've got a particular style of astrology. Each of the people you've heard today have their styles of astrology as multivariate styles of approaching our subject as the colours of the zodiac itself. So no one way of approach can state this is how to approach this subject. So that'll be my rider at the beginning, my apology to you as I've then gone to tell you how you ought to understand the subject from my point of view. I like very much the theme of rites of passage, and I did ask Kat and Lindsay whether they had, to what extent they'd elected the horoscope of the day, and these things are very difficult to fiddle with one's times and events, but there is a degree of choice, and I think it's a very interesting choice that was made, the horoscope of the day, which I will show a little later and show how I think it bears out the theme very, very excellently. As we expect as symbolists, it's odd how reality plays, isn't it? It plays together with us in some way. Not quite as we want or in a way that is under our command or ken, yet we know that we're in play with it. So, I'm going to perhaps, the lights can be dimmed at that point. I think the photograph has been taken. Thank you. We can have, if you can put on the low lights, it doesn't have to be, we don't have to be completely cinema experience here. It's just that these will give a decent light, won't they? Even for the photographer, I'm sure. Now, yes, there was I saw a glimpse of a lovely illustration that I was going to show you in our last presentation by Liz, and they're appearing at the bottom of the picture, and I'll just show you. And it's a well-known one for we astrologers. That particular picture is much, much known. I don't think it's very ancient, actually. I've not really traced anything earlier than the 19th century with this, so I think it's quite late. It's in the collection of Flammarion, and it shows the pilgrim at the end of the world. And it's a useful one for we astrologers, because the Pilgrim has come through the stars, sun, moon, planets, through the ordinary world, and poking his head, just got managed to get his head through this other realm, this other order. Now, do bear in mind, it interests me greatly, astrology exists in two orders. It exists as a thing in the world, of the ordinary world. There's a horoscope, there's a textbook, here us, here, literally here. You can see all that actually in this world here, the world below the celestial sphere. And yet, doing this carries us into some other place, which was a theme earlier today, some other place. And this is what the mystery of the rites of passage of astrology are really about. Now, I did want to briefly talk about vocation. What I'm going to do with you today, I might have to be cut short in my prime if I go too far on these themes, because there's so much to talk about. But what I wanted to talk to you about is, first of all, the ordinary and objective sense of rites of passage, as we know it, in culture and society. And then what that means for the astrologer, and then the question of astrology's own place, because astrology itself and each of us as astrologers are undergoing a continuing rite of passage in our own culture. And I was very fascinated in the talk this morning about the various stages of the rites of passage. You see, we astrologers are quite good at the separation. We do, in fact, separate ourselves off from all right-thinking people, and most regard us as this, but we do this most strange thing by becoming astrologers. And then we go into this transition of a complete chaos and muddle. Who knows where that's going? Do we manage to do the aggregation? Do we manage to do this conjunctur and bring it all back together again? So this was a question for Sabrina. So we astrologers ourselves are continually undergoing this strange passage. Now, what is it that makes those of you who receive certificates and diploma today, what you've done is occupied a cultural space, and it's very like the mid-heaven. Very like the mid-heaven. And it's like that part of the horoscope where the ascendant is going up into the public place. And for you traditional and Hellenistic astrologers, it's like the day sect planets, Sun, Jupiter and Saturn. These are planets of culture, society, where you've come out in the world. And you've been named as that in the world. And the personal has now become something public. That's what a rite of passage in gaining certification and diplomahood grants you. The older astrologers, Lily's Day, would call the 10th house magistracy. It's where mastery or mystery or magistracy is gained. You became a master, either gender, of your art. And all of the great vocations lead one through to this mystery of the mid-heaven. And of course, the mid-heaven axis that joins the zenith directly overhead to the celestial polar axis where the whole universe turns, brought to a symbol of the place where the sun will be at noon, nooning at that degree of the zodiac. That is what's being announced when a calling is announced and honoured and respected in society. And that's the individual made social and made public in their duties. Now, it's only certain of the great trades and professions that can honestly name vocation in this way. Medicine, law, arts, all of these are vocations or callings. And so is the astrologer. And so indeed is the religious vocation, the spiritual vocation. Now, what connects all of those great vocations is that they align the collective of humanity with the utter beyond that we know not, but honour, and that we know surrounds us, that can be called the divine, the ultimate. That is the mystery that underlies a vocation such as astrology, that we connect humanity with this otherness. Now, we have many faces as astrologers, and we know from Henrik, talking about Far Eastern experience, if many of you do deal with clients who come from the Indian subcontinent, or a lot of clients who come from the Far East, you know that ordinarily you're expected to be offering fortune telling to those clients, and we as psychologicalised Westerners find this a difficult jump. But what does fortune telling represent? It's a desire of the individual to align themselves and be spoken to and from this place of the ultimate. That's why people seek out mediums and fortune tellers over and over again, because they're seeking the connectedness to this. And one of the great powers of astrology is that it, compared with other forms, genuine forms of counselling and therapy and help, it also gives that sense of the connection with the ultimacy of things, the cosmos itself, taking us beyond even our current social and political concerns, taking us up to this other level of humanity. That's why astrology is a great vocation that attends to a mystery that is the mystery of human being and the universe itself. And that's why it will always appear in these countless different forms, many of them difficult for us. That's why people, we are always being asked to be soothsayers, to tell the fate, to tell of the destiny. And that there is that in our work. So, what does that mean for the individual astrologer entering this? It is an extraordinary task. So, let me move a bit forward and show you how this was conceived by in earlier ages. Now I'm going to show you some illustrations that show this higher work of astrology. This is a less well-known woodcut amongst astrologers. I'll show you one in a minute that's quite well-known. This appears in... you'll find that historians of astronomy collect things like this and associate it with astronomy as such. But very properly, this type of understanding, this is from an almanac of 1513, a lunarium, in which may be looked up the conjunctions and oppositions, lunar conjunction and oppositions, eclipses of the sun and the moon, through the circle of the year, movable feasts, the golden numbers and the dominical letters that allow you to date the religious festivals and Easter according to the religious calendar. All of this is an almanac. Fine. And that particular work is a work of the careful computation. It's a careful ephemeris to give you the dates of the eclipse, times of the eclipse, and vernacular grammar. That is modern terms, we'll call him an astronomer. He's also a court astrologer. And at that time, this is the early 16th century, we can still say of astrology that it is also what we now call astronomy, and that both are, this whole is a divine science, and its knowledge elevates mind, or elevates soul, towards something higher. This is what's been announced, and it's announced commonly in the almanacs and ephemerides of this time. Now there's a... Look at the text there. I'll show you this in a... Let's see if I show you in another form. Let's see. Yes, yeah, so this is a... I'm no Latinist. This is a very dense little phrasing of the Latin. Do you see the... altior incubit animus sub imagine... Magine Mundi. That's what that says. And you see the obviously a person there who's knowledgeable about the celestial sphere, knows mathematics and trigonometry. Vernacular grammar actually is quite an expert at spherical trigonometry and other things. So this man has mathematical knowledge and he's looking at the worlds or the spheres there. But look, you see something there is rising above him, the person above him, the thing, the higher mind, obviously, pointing at the sun. And that pointing at the sun tells you that's more like the sun that's beyond the world that we see ordinarily. It's the sun of suns. It's the sun that lights the universe itself. He's pointing to something else. Otherwise, the text wouldn't really make much sense. So you've got a... There you have it. An almanac, a lunar and calendrical almanac, where it is announced that incubated under this contemplation of astronomy stroke astrology, incubated under it, hatched, brooded under it, brooding under the image of the world, image, the symbol of the world seen mathematically and then measured, and yet what happens, higher mind is incubated by this study. That goes right back to Plato and beyond. The contemplation of the stars is the highest possible philosophy that can be, because it will encompass wisdom and truth and art and science at once. So there's higher mind being incubated. Now this becomes even more explicit in a diagram that has become more known. It's the same theme, the same language being used. The same altio incubit animus subimagine mundi, mind, that can be, it's a difficult word to translate that animus, it could be mind or soul in a certain sense, it's not soul as anima, so, or mind itself. Higher mind is incubated under the image of the world. Now this makes it more explicit, this is 1515 astronomical text. Here we see, mentioned I think by Kat, Lady Astrology. Lady Astrology. Who's she hatching there? You see, that's the astrologer again, actually. That's the chap studying things. He's almost popping out of her womb, actually. She's hatching him. She's popping out of her. And she is commanding him to look across to Ptolemy. Why Ptolemy? Because Ptolemy gives us the construction of the heavens. He gives us the complete cosmology, physical and literal cosmology of the world under which we are all living, the Ptolemaic universe, completely embedded in both Greek scientific understanding. The master of the calculation of the celestial sphere. So, look across, be an astronomer, the astrologer must master the actual mechanics and trigonometry and nature of this and work at understanding this. It is mathematical understanding. But out of that, you see the world, mundus, doesn't simply mean the earth, it means the universe as well, mundus. Everything, reality, complete reality as we perceive it, is contained within this vast celestial sphere. That is the medieval and the ancient cosmos that's come down in our tradition, our transmission. And what happens? Higher mind is incubated. Now that's clearly astrology performing this. That's what we mean by astrology, is the symbolic incubation of a further understanding of the visible world as given to us, worked and understood scientifically and mathematically. Scientia means nothing like what modern science means in this conception. It means something under God, that is near to God himself. So I can interpret that, actually. I hope. Interpretation, yes, there you go. Really, I go so far as to say it's higher mind is incubated under the symbol of astrology. Astrology itself is symbol. It is a symbol or metaphor for mind rising within the sensory of reality given to us and measured to us and known to us. That being pictured truly, mind rises by this metaphor of astrology. And that's the incubation that's taking place. So when I say rite of passage, the astrologer, understanding this and working with this, is working with the greatest possible metaphor of all to lift mind to a higher place. That is what such statements are making. And that's the tradition that we are all in, and that you are in, and that you are the next generation of, carrying this forward, this tradition. Now we carry it forward into troubled times for astrology, because that physical cosmos has gone out the window, went. The Ptolemaic universe and the whole mastery, the whole cosmos and cosmology of that age has gone. What is left to us is the metaphor. But that's a struggle. Much easier to be an astrologer in 1500 when everything about the science and construction of the universe supports what you do. It's obvious. Astrology is an obvious truth. Astrologers, for many thinkers of the late medieval period, they would doubt the capacity of your eye to really see details in the horoscope. They say, I doubt your clever judgment, you're being too smart. But nobody would doubt that we are contained in this vast cosmic frame that is itself symbol of divinity, which contains human being as its very essence and substance, united with God. And all of our arts and sciences are there, and astrology is a necessary part of that understanding. So, but we come into rockier times in this millennium, because we have to rework all our understandings where we cannot rely on the literal physical frame of cosmology. So modern cosmology screams at us for even using the word. People calling themselves cosmologists today in university departments will have nothing to do with us saying it's all metaphorical. Well, let us say it's that they don't mind us making up metaphors about it, but the idea that that's truthful in any way is, of course, absurd. So, now I'm going to, because I said there's no point in all this unless one's practicing it, let me move forward, or else I'll only ever do my introduction. I'm not going to do that to you. Right. I promised you wise counsel from the past here. Well, these diagrams are wise counsel. But let's go to another wise counsel here. For a lot of modern astrology, despite many efforts, it's still got itself stuck trying to deal with the realm of sense and the ideas of causation, and not fully buying into the nature of the symbolic power that astrology itself is symbol and metaphor, and is not a set of causes of any sort whatsoever. Bears no resemblance to what we mean when we talk of cause and effect. Is a different alternative reality to that. And that goes right back to understanding as time is talking. Acknowledging that in his day it would be reasonable to think the stars had some general influence in a practical, physical way. Nevertheless, that is not the importance of symbol and astrology for Plotinus or any of those thinkers. Their symbolic power covers everything. There's a phrase used by very fine English astrologer Dennis Elwell, and it's a good phrase. Astrology is not an add-on. Astrology is not an add-on. What does he mean? What Dennis Elwell meant by that is that astrology does not, speaking in sort of philosophic terms, doesn't belong in the realm of contingent causes. It's not yet one other set of causes amongst things. It exists as an entirely different reality. If I say my friend is an Aries and shows all those Aryan characteristics, God love her, cotton socks, etc., and I name her as an Aries, being an Aries adds nothing whatsoever to the physical, chemical and biological composition of the being as known by our sciences. It is entirely different. It's a mode in which the world is revealed and human being is revealed, occupying an entirely different level of meaning. It's meaningful at a different level to the world of causes. That's what Dennis Elwell says, astrology is not an add-on. Why Plotinus says its symbolic power of this covers everything. There is nothing in reality that cannot be framed in mind or thought that cannot then be symbolised by the symbolist using the language of astrology. All that is symbolised. That's why, of course, it is inexhaustible, the subject we study. There is no end to where you can take this symbolism. So, obvious enough in a way, you might say. This, of course, has to come into practice. And I've already said to you that there's something that people want from us as astrologers that goes very deep indeed. And it goes, this is the best way of opening it, the nature of desire. That's such an interesting word for us because of its astrological connotation. And this is something that's interested some of us in astrology for many years, and Darby, I know, who's there, has written on the nature of desire, and would I hope agree with these reflections. Desire, longing, yearning, absolutely heartfelt longing for something, and that goes beyond any one thing. You think it's a lover or some other thing, or lack of success, this, that and the other, but that yearning belongs to the foundation of human beings. And it is the Sirius of or from the stars, yearning to reach back to the cosmos out of which we are all born. That's the yearning we are depend and come from. And of course we do quite literally come from the stars. There's even at the gross modern cosmological astrophysical level, that's the truth, that's a literal truth. But symbolically and profoundly, it is an extraordinary truth. We are from the whole universe, which is then shown to us in these masses and countless masses of stars. And we yearn. That yearning takes people into both astronomy and astrology. It's that yearning that children feel when they look at the night sky, and some children then will become fascinated by astronomy. But for us, astrology, you have that yearning when you see the sky. We come from those stars. The greatest possible symbol, therefore. And indeed, just to extend this note, an early word in Latin for the Eucharist, the sacraments of the Holy Communion, the desiderata, that which is to be desired is communion with divinity. All other things are short of that. So the desperate search for my fate, my fortune, when will I meet my lover, are all reflections of a greater desire. And that, of course, is a very Platonic teaching as well. This is deep in our tradition and deep within the philosophy of astrology. Similar use of the word Sirius in considerare, to consider. For us, this is quite literally so. That's why I would say, sounding much too smart and philosophical, but that astrology is the hermeneutic of desire. It is the interpreting of the yearning for the stars in each and every form in which it occurs. We do have a considerable edge on the psychoanalysts here, I tell you, a considerable edge. Yes. Now, great mysteries here about the nature of astrology. I might as well be practical about this and show you the horoscope I was talking about, or else I'll never get round to it, will I? I was very intrigued by this as a symbolic showing. Now, for me, those of you who know my work, and I'm very interested in the relationship of astrology, practical astrology, to practical divination, and using the metaphor or language of divination to reveal what's happening in astrology. So I go for showings, omina. Things that show, and that for me astrology is one of the things that show this other world, and it bursts through sometimes. But I say sometimes, because actually you can't, the odd thing about being incarnated in a physical body with time, space, dimensions that we have, is you can't live this all the time. It's odd, you know, when you've experienced in your life this other thing, you know you've experienced it and you'll never forget it. And you you yearn to have this again happen to you. It's like people in their enlightenments, they yearn to have those enlightenment moments again. and it might not be reached for years or ever at all, but you have it, and you know the little moments at which it's trying to show through. For me, moments of astrology are like that, when symbol comes to life in front of you, and you say, ah, you see, you laugh, there's an involuntary gasp. As you realise symbolism, it actually has a physiological effect on your body. It usually leads to a little gasp of laughter and joy, actually. And the odd thing about that, which people who aren't astrologers can never understand, Dorian invited me to break a leg, which is using the actual phrase here. Even on breaking a leg, an astrologer will, my God, that second transit was perfect, wasn't it? On breaking a leg, there will also be this extraordinary moment of recognition that is a love, that it, even in the middle of suffering, that is a love. It's very, very odd. That has a transcendent power for people in grief. When symbol can come in, can show, it cannot guarantee this at all, but when it happens, it is most moving for somebody with a symbolic attitude than to see there's something fitting an act. It's as if the universe has called and this is the way things will be, and you see it showing to you. The other order has come in there, and you know you're touching whatever the word fate means, or destiny or providence, you're touching these great words. So I've gone far away from this horoscope. Ordinary, for the regular astrologer, into modern astrology, into the soup of New Age thinking, New Age astrology. Pluto, so there's Pluto right in the descendant. Now that looks like a tunnel you're going to have to go down. I'm just looking. The horoscope has interesting planes in it. It looks like the idea. The rite of passage is a passing through a difficult and dark place in order that this other thing is revealed. Always, it seems, some type of sacrifice is called for this to be achieved. That is what the rite of passage is about, a sacrifice of giving up. Well, of course, that looks like a dark tunnel. More traditionally, and it was very interesting to bring the mention in the ninth house in Sorosweb, Neptune up near the mid-heaven, and I agree. The moon there, long reach to go, is trying to get through to that Neptune. That, to my mind, is like a popular mystical conception that people do have of the heavens, that the drives forward will always drive forward popular astrology. That is like a mass astrology reaching for this mystery. Well, there's a tunnel, moon on the south node, if you're a more learned astrologer. That's a bit of a tunnel. Balsamic moon on the south node in order to get to this ninth house wisdom. Well, that's like another play on that Pluto on the seventh. And there's quite a tunnel to go through. Moon in the dark on a south node where things have to be expelled. Ooh. Uncomfortable indeed. Now, I did think that was an extraordinary horoscope because, as a modern traditional astrologer, and into horror and similar things, I cannot but be moved by the Kazemi placing of Venus in this map. Now, it struck me that there's something there that I'm not able to, and I won't try to fully interpret at this point, but I know it's showing something. There's something about the exaltation of joy in art and poetry itself, in that Venus and the Sun, in that four areas, 2 minutes of arc away from it. Kazemi is within 17 minutes of the heart of the Sun. It's a very traditional Arabic type of teaching, very used in horary. Beautiful place. So that struck me, that is trying to announce some extreme joy that is achieved as you achieve this 10th house vocation of calling, an extreme joy. So this horoscope is quite hot, and I'll try to show you this as it pops up again. In fact, it led me to make a decision about showing you a very early, what I'll do is show you a couple of instances of astrology. And I'll show you one from very, very early in my first stumblings into doing astrology for anybody else other than me. First stumblings. But before I do that, Let me see. Brief philosophical thoughts from those who can guide us. Back. Sorry. Nearly missed it. I found that I can't go to places with Dorian and astrologers involved without the lot of diamond emerging to a high degree of significance. And I hope that I'm very surprised with that. And that's because of the work that Dorian Greenbaum has done on Hellenistic astrology, not simply on its techniques and its literature, but on its philosophic depth with regard to the nature of higher mind and destiny and providence. And that's work that Dorian has been doing, and she's very much brought forward the idea of using the lots, as the Hellenistic astrologers would use, and the parts. Part of fortune is a lot of fortune. And there's the lot of diamond, 21 there. And I had to put it in, knowing that Dorian would be here, she'd be across from me. Because now look, in another dimension of this chart, if you're more horror-oriented, dynamic horror-oriented, you'll see within the chart, Mercury is conjunct Uranus, and it's a prime conjunction of Uranus right on the 11th cusp. And, well, this is a particular hobby horse of mine, but I would announce this as a doctrine of astrology that you can put in your little notebooks and it will come out sometime. In terms, certainly, of modern horoscopic astrology, when you see a relationship that's intimate between the 9th and the 11th houses, especially Lord of the 9th on the 11th cusp, you're talking the way the diamond or the angelic shows forth. It's a very... The 11th house in a horoscope is Agatha's diamond, good diamond. It is the place of the good diamond. And the good diamond is a place of providence. Now here we have Uranus, not the ruler of the 9th, on the 11th, therefore the faculty's choice at this moment for rites of passage providentially allows this thought of the good diamond. And that also is what we're doing as astrologers. You're passing into becoming astrologers by being there to serve this providential showing that comes from the realm of the divine, the 9th, and shows at this place of the good diamond, the 11th. For me, it's Uranus, because the huge challenge for us as a modern generation of astrologers is to correctly understand the symbol of the disintegration of the old cosmos and the rise of a new order that we have to live in, symbolised by the Transaturnians in turn, starting with Uranus. But that's a big story. Would require another afternoon seminar to go into, but that is why Uranus is, and the Transaturnians are crucial in modern astrology. Much as I respect the traditionist who wishes to say the great purity of a pre-Transaturnian system, for me, for me, the calling of astrology, we've been called to modern planets as we've been called to a modern cosmos. What that means in practice is quite another matter, so I'm not going to try and solve it for you. But before that Mercury, who will be the interpreter here, the act of interpretation, gets to Uranus, he passes trine the diamond on the 3rd. And that meant I never had to speak about the loss of diamond, because it's on the 3rd, and Mercury is getting there. He's interfering with my nice Mercury-Uranus conjunction. So thank you, Dorian. So... how are we doing? Yes. Guidance from Jung here coming. Now, that's to represent to you the only way that I can successfully negotiate lectures these days is by having disparate slides that force me to advance to the next thought. And I think, oh, I'm supposed to be talking about that now. I'm supposed to talk about this now. The symbol of astrology as metaphor means in practice that it is a metaphoric mirror that can be brought to any one or any situation of reality whatsoever. A mirror of celestial metaphor is brought to the situation, and we know the power of this. We know that what happens is the person brought to the mirror sees themselves as if providentially naked, naked to the heavens to face a destiny, naked to some other order of things. So there's the astrologer, Astrolene, there with her beads. She has her clients, she's brought her clients into the metaphoric mirror. Client then now sees herself in this greater frame. That's an extraordinary thing that we do, and that's the marvel of the work of the astrologer, of all forms of astrologer, psychological counselling, traditional, of all forms, bring this mirror to us. And that mirror is the Annie has to cut her head around. That's her calculating her horoscopes and doing her bits and bobs. She's wheeling this thing around. Along comes the client, and something can happen. The client can be seen in it, and hopefully see herself in it. Now, this metaphoric mirror is tricky. Next slide. Help from Jung. You then ask, because you're puzzled about these things, you say, does that mean that the truth of astrology is simply inside Astroanatic plus the client that she's brought? And it's just in this place there, and it isn't really in the world? Or is it objective, and can it be tested because it's objectively real? Is it objective or subjective? And as Jung says in dealing with this matter, nature is not so simple as to divide itself up into either subjective or objective. And most extraordinarily, that's the alchemist's place there, the alchemist's ovens and retorts. The metaphoric mirror, the naked person steps out from this mirror into the world. So it becomes both true in the world, in the ordinary world, as well as being true in this other world. So there's something odd going on. And always with our astrology, you feel there's something odd going on, that what turned out to be an exercise in symbolism suddenly becomes more real than you could have imagined, and indeed ties you, the astrologer, up in it in some funny way as well. The astrologer is all part of this game as well. We are not, from this point of view, objective professionals working a particular thing for a client's benefit. We are entering with the client into this other realm, a much more profound thing that we're doing. That's why astrology is one of the holy vocations. So, how are we doing for time? We're doing for time. Now, what this leads to is a level of inquiry of thought that I promise you, bore you completely to tears with, but I won't. But it is the whole idea that what we keep missing as astrologers, one thing I feel we miss too very often, is we go ahead and treat it in the straightforward, the objective way. Bring the client to mirror, wheel your stuff around, there's an Astro Annie wheeling the stuff, get the job done, which is fair enough, that's what you do most of the time. And we miss the fact that we should look reflectively at what happens when symbol becomes real for us as astrologers. What does it mean, symbolism becoming real? And the psychologists are ahead of us in this respect, especially the Jungians. Jung's idea of there being the secret left-handed handshake that occurs between analyst and analysand. Well, there's a secret left-handed handshake between astrologer and client, and any person that the astrologer speaks astrology to, i.e. an unconscious working together of two psyches at a level that isn't obvious to ordinary consciousness, where things begin to happen between astrologer and client. That too means that there's this other mystery in astrology, and being reflective about what symbolism is should be very important in our studies. And I suppose one of the things I always appeal, I'm not trying to put any pressure on faculty or anything to say this, but one of the things that I regard when I see there's work of many schools in astrology and in Western astrology, there's still, to my mind, an underemphasis on what is a symbol and what a major theory set symbolism is, rather than let's get on and use these symbols. We can now learn about tertiaries, or learn about primary directions with our latitude and things like that. What on earth is the first step of the symbolising act. And I will suggest to you, there is a, we astrologers do need to get wise to a whole development in modern thought that can help us here. And I'll go forward too. We're very fond of this man's work in we're fond of the McGilchrist work in the work we do at Canterbury, because this idea that the brain, this is from neuroscience and neurophysiology, that the brain actually operates along two broad ways of moving, one right hemispheric lateralization and the other left hemispheric, and they produce two rather different realities. It's very interesting. And some of you who know my work, I think I can tie that successfully together with very interesting studies that the anthropologists do. Let me show you this. This is from the work of Barbara Tedlock, anthropologist. And I'll encapsulate this briefly by saying that in fortune-telling systems worldwide and practical divination systems worldwide, experienced practitioners will be found to frequently say, when asked about their subject, that there are broadly three different categories to the work they do. One type of divination is the bones, the throwing of the bones, the witch doctor's bones, and people who know the Sangomas of South Africa and know that tradition. Rod Suskind. Know that for the African Sangoma, our horoscope is their bones. They're your bag of bones. You cast the bag of bones, that's the heavens, and we read the bones. Now that's quite an act of actual interpretation using language that can be understood by others. One Sangoma can look over another Sangoma's shoulder and see if he's oddly read the bones. You can look at another astrologer judging transits in a client's horoscope and say, well, you seem to have missed the significance of that Jupiter transit. You've gone and said all these things, and I think you're missing this. And then the two can have a conversation. Now, this is astrology entering into rational, logical discourse and language. And that's bones divination. There's another type of divination that is much more like the medium, just picking up an intuition from within, but it rests on the authority of the medium, and you can't, one medium can't say you didn't see Uncle Henry, because I didn't see Uncle Henry. No, if the medium says I saw Uncle Henry, well, that's it. You have to take it or leave it. You can't, you know, you're stuck. Whereas if an astrologer says you've got a heavy Jupiter period coming up, and I say, no, you're wrong, I can see it's something else. You see, it's a different type of... So there's a difference, and yet they're all divination. And at the far end, you get towards altered states of consciousness, trance, reality, and the appearance of spirits and spirit phenomena, where the medium will now be in possibly a deep trance, and then spirit phenomena occur. That at the far end of the circle, we don't do that normally. Most astrologers I know don't do that. A lot of astrologers I know are in this area. And Barbara Tedlock says that divination practice generally moves along this continuum. So when an astrologer, Barbara Tedlock can say this, I'm extrapolating, we get these moments where we're rationally going through the horoscope, this must mean that, I wonder if I had a sticky theory last January, then the client says something, and you say, oh, that's exactly, you know it, and then you know something else, as if a spirit's spoken to you, you know what you should say about that, as if it comes from another source. And in fact, every practicing astrologer knows this. And in fact, what you're putting two and two together, you're actually employing two hemispheres of the brain, not one. And you're shifting across. You're shifting from right to left hemisphere, left to right hemisphere, back and forth. All of our interpretation is like that. Learning your technical astrology, you have to do it as if it's all left hemisphere. You have to. Actually out in the world as it comes to life, it swings into the right hemisphere as well, and both join up together. The marvel of astrology as a form of truth-telling, soothsaying, seeing destiny is that it encompasses both. It encompasses a full range from logic and intellect, mathematics, through to feeling that hunch that you know what it is. And the point about that hunch astrology is you can still explain it to your astrologer and you'll say, that is Jupiter, but I see Jupiter as this, this and this. And provided you're using the Jupiter language, Jupiter metaphors, the astrologer says, yes, I see where you got that from. The beauty of the astrologic language. So that is why astrology is quite unique as a divinatory system, actually. Yes, I must get to a case. Must get to a practical example. What I'm going to write, give me a moment. I'm going to show you something I showed years and years ago, but it isn't in any book I've written. My book, incidentally, is on sale. You'll see similar cases to this. You'll see similar cases. Yes, I'm going to flash through. Please forgive me flashing through things. You'll say, stop there, that looks interesting. Why don't you show me that? I won't. Why don't you show me that? Right. Right, I will just go into this little case with you. And I do that with you because I had a hunch that I should probably talk about an early client case. And this was really very, very early on. This is probably the first time I was really doing astrology, and I was doing it with another astrologer, with a couple of friends. And and another young lady said, oh, can you do my horoscope, to both of us? And that's it. And I then started doing the horoscope, and I was talking with my friend about how we should approach it. And this is a very simple stumbling into early astrology. I've slightly disguised data for confidentiality purposes. So I've slightly disguised the degree of the ascendant in heaven. But all the planetary placings are exact to the minute, and the cusps are exact, virtually as they are there. So let me tell you this story. This was a young lady who said she'd in a bit of a state about where her life was going, especially with love. Heard that one before? Right. And me and my friend, who was just getting into astrology at the same time, we were staying in a remote place on the coast, in Wales, when this occurred. And we were both agreeing that we would do this piece of work. And we noticed that the woman concerned had just a slight stutter or something, a slight halt in her speech. And it struck us this must be significant. And then when we looked at the horoscope, of course, we generally rising Mercury in Aries, dead opposite Saturn in Libra, big opposition. We thought, oh well, oh dear, that looks difficult, doesn't it? And with Pluto on the third, well, we both thought, remember how clear this was, oh, communication problem. Problem in communication. Now, isn't that a banal and general sort of thing to say? It's like out of a textbook. But the odd thing about that is, it becomes so true. You see, that's the banal textbook piece observation then becomes so true. Because what burst out then when we said that to her, she said, oh yes, when she was a kid at school, she'd always disappointed her father, who was a very highly placed individual, powerful man, who expected well of his children. And she'd been slow at school, and it had been years before it had been discovered that she was deaf in one ear. And she wasn't actually hearing about lessons. And so her slowness at school was all not hearing the lessons. And the relationship problem she then had. Now look at this for simple astrology. There's a huge T-square, Saturn opposite Mercury, both square Uranus in Cancer. And of course, she was quite rebellious against her father. And you can see that's a 10th house, Mercury Saturn opposition. So all of that came out. And then it seemed obvious to us in the horoscope. We haven't been very clever astrologers. If you'd have been a Lily, like I said, you were deaf, or you are deaf in one ear. I'm not that good. It's a communication problem, and that's quite enough to get there. It's quite enough to get there. Now, as you know from your 101 astrology, how do you resolve T-squares? With Chiron, that actually becomes a round cross, but I won't mention that because we're doing Chiron at that time, because Chiron's in around that degree in Capricorn. How do you release it? You release it through the trine. Uranus, trine Mars. Notice, please, that Mars, dispositor of this tremendous Sun-Jupiter group in the event, she's going to idealise someone who can carry that energy for her, isn't she? A friend who might be something more. Jupiter, Lord of the Seventh. Mars in Scorpio, the dispositor of that group up there, she'd taken up with a guy whose nickname was Red. His nickname was Red. And he was a hot Welsh nationalist. And he had this, he must have thought she's a upper-class English bitch or something. Because it's the time when they were burning cottages over the second homes by the English. So he hated the English. I tried not to be around him too much, but there was one time he said he was cleaning his revolver. And because he was such a Welsh man, he insisted that she speak the Welsh. So he'd take her to pubs, Welsh pubs, where they were all speaking in Welsh, and expected her to, as if the Israeli there, and he expected her to learn to speak back to him in Welsh. And she's got this Mercury sat up. She's living out the very same thing, isn't she? She's going to be, she said, I find it difficult hearing the pubs because they're shouting. In a pub, when people shout loud and you do have a hearing problem, you can't hear anything. And if they're speaking, if they're shouting in Welsh. So the horoscope, in every sense, the horoscope, you see, what happens then? Tiny incident of beginner's astrology stumbled into, opens out this whole story where she makes sense of it more than the astrologer ever can. But as an astrologer, I can see how exactly this symbolism works out in this real world. Because it's only when you see the reality, then the symbol comes to life. If you don't have reality, you've got to use left hemisphere, textbook, communication problem, problem perhaps for equal temple, if you say, if you must be. Then, bang, life comes in and allows it to show for the benefit of all parties, actually, certainly for the benefit of them, as far as I can tell, for the benefit of women themselves. Now, that was probably my very first example of using astrology on another unfortunate human being. I've gone on to much develop my prowess there, since then.
And I just want to show you this, why I knew I had to show this.
Now, this is a bit typical of Uranus. You old diehards will say. Look at that rites of passage map that opened the day. Uranus 2320. Miss A's son 2320. In my early days, I've got an afflicted Jupiter. I've got Virgo wrong in my chart. I love high technical astrology. So I did lots of stuff on zero. Even some astrologers are amazed if you say this is so. You can work astrology to zero all if you want to do that, and you will get results that entice you to go further down this completely futile path. Because it will do that. I learned that astrology from Chester Kemp at the Astrological Lodge, an extraordinary technical astrologer. Crazy zero all astrology. The topocentric authors in South America is zero, so it does work. And of course, Uranus always is fond of playing a game of zero all for you. But of course, the other bit of that map is that Sun Venus conjunction. Look at this lady's Venus, and I realise, my goodness, I mean, it's zero all, a bit loose, and in the same grid. So that Venus at four Aries is right in that extraordinary Sun-Venus conjunction. So I thought, oh, well, I've got to use this map, haven't I? That's how decisions taken, you see.
This is the masterly way in which presentations are made.
I probably should stop at that point. And perhaps I can invite, there might be time for one or two questions. Let's see, I will come to, let me flash through for, yes, lots of things. Okay, I had many, many more exciting things to show. They will have to go for another day. I'll just come back to this horoscope for you. That's what we're all doing, isn't it? That's what we honour and serve in our vocation. And that's the passage that astrology still has to make for the benefit of culture and society in our time. We still have to make that move, each of us having our individual rite of passage, but astrology itself still has its work to do. So, thank you.
Out of time. Well, we could listen to you for hours and